This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight you're going to hear the second part of my conversation with Avril Seal on his book, Monster Hike. Patreons already got this whole interview plus an extra segment, so if you want to become a patron and get extra stuff and help out the show, wheredidtheroadgo.com will get you there, as well as everything else Where Did the Road Go related. Everything's linked on the page in some manner. And also a quick update, for those of you who listen to this show on WVBR, which is where the main show airs first, that is going to be moving its time slot from 11 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern. So it's going to be going back an hour, and I'm going to aim to make the shows probably closer to an hour and a half rather than an hour, hour 10. So you're going to get a slightly longer main show. It's not going to affect the roundtables and stuff like that we put up during the week. But as far as the main interview show that generally airs on Saturday, it's going to be an hour earlier. So if you listen to the show, like I said, on WVBR, then it's going to be an hour earlier for you. And my show, The Last Exit's going to start at 11:30. So it'll be an hour and a half for Where Did the Road Go? And I like that idea. It saves me from having to rush things in when I'm doing the main show. All right, without any further ado, here's the conversation with Avril Seal. So I am back here with Avril Seal. I got that right, right?
That's it.
All right. And this is part two of our conversation about your book, Monster Hike, A 100-Mile Inquiry into the Sasquatch Mystery. And I want to say this book is very personable. You do talk a lot about getting prepared for the hike and what it means to you, and just some life philosophies mixed in there as well. And you said this is kind of a memoir as much as anything else.
Yeah, that's the literary form that it takes. I had read a number of books that were kind of textbook-like on Bigfoot, and they were good insofar as what they were. But I wanted to do something a little more creative as far as the narrative of this goes. And this is just kind of the thing that this is kind of the style that I'm drawn to.
It's definitely a different style of Bigfoot book. So you mix your stories on the trail along with stories of, things in your life here and there that are going on, plus, theories on Bigfoot. And so it's kind of a mash of all these different ideas.
A monster mash. Sorry.
Exactly.
Couldn't resist.
One of the things you mentioned at the beginning I wanted to get into a little bit is the Patterson film.
Right.
And you say a lot of stuff in here that mimics how I kind of feel about it. Like this, it would have been something very hard to fake at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, the Planet of the Apes was kind of state of the art in makeup and prosthetics in that time. In fact, I think it was the very same year, 67, I think was the first year that the Charlton Heston movie came out, and so it doesn't pass the smell test that this was some guy in a suit. And a lot of several people have claimed that it was them in a suit, and so right away that somebody's lying, because it wasn't several people.
Right.
If it was anybody, it was one person. So but they've tried to recreate it. And you can just tell right away, you can tell a hoax from this thing, because for a lot of different reasons. But the first tell is the proportions of the arms and legs to the torso. Then you've got as technology has gotten better, when I looked at this footage as a kid, well, it's shaky, it's blurry, the thing is tiny in the frame, and it's shaking all over the place, and who knows what it is. At that point, you know, we as kids or as even as young adults, we just didn't have really the versions of this that we have now. Now it's been, they've gone back and gotten the original print. They've digitized it in high def. They've stabilized it. They've zoomed in on it. They've done, you know, some color correction and contrast work. And you can see muscles bulging under the hair of this thing. I mean, you can go on YouTube and there's probably 100 different versions of the Patterson-Gimlin film that show it. There are GIFs of it where they've stabilized the background and show it walking across. And it's just remarkable. And there are all of these biometric indicators that this is something that would have been just exceedingly hard to fake. For one thing, the muscles rippling. There's a hernia in her right thigh that you see bulging out when she steps down on it. We know it's a she because of the anatomy that's apparent in the film, the pendulous breasts,
right?
Which vast majority of people would never. If you were gonna make a monster fake, you know, hoax of a monster film, would you pick a female?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Bigfoot by default, I think people think of as a male.
Yeah. But it's just clearly not. I mean, you can look at it and there it is. That's why they call her Patty, the subject in the film. So on and on, and the closer you look at that film, the more points of proof come to light. And even National Geographic, they did an entire special on it. They used photogrammetry to establish, you know, they replicated the camera. They got they discovered the lens that Roger Patterson was using when he shot it. They went to Bluff Creek. They've got the landmark trees in the right position. And estimated, you know, where he was when he fell, and so on and so forth, and they've established the height of the creature. I think it's 7'3" or 7'4", something like that. Was the height of that creature? This is National Geographic,
right?
This is not some kook, you know, on a blog or, you know, that's just making a claim. And yeah. Interestingly, you know, she left a trackway too, and so they cast prints from that trackway. And they've got her, they established her height in that. And, you know, when I got back, after I took this photo that's on the cover, and I got back home, just on a lark, I went on the internet and I Googled Bigfoot height and weight extrapolated from print length or something like that. And boom, first hit, somebody had done a paper. And they had used the Patterson-Gimlin film as the guide because I think she had I'm a little rusty on these statistics, so don't quote me on it, but something like a 15-inch print, and she was 7'3", and the best estimates were that, you know, based on certain biological principles, were that she was probably 550 pounds or something like that. So they had taken the footprint length and said, okay, a creature that's leaving a print this long is probably this tall and weighs this much. And mine was 18 inches. And using that table, they extrapolated it at 8'2", I believe it was, in something like 775 pounds. And I believe it. I believe those in that. I think that's probably conservative. And by the way, I also entered, what would that be in a shoe size? If somebody, as I went to my shoes, and it was a size 36, 11E was, wow. Was the width on it. So even bigger than Shaq's.
You know, if that film had come out today, I think there'd be a better argument for it, you know, the potential of it being a fake.
Oh yeah.
But at that time, it, you know, it's obviously not CGI.
Mm-hmm.
There's no easy explanation for that film. And the fact that some people just throw it away, you know, they admitted to faking it. It's like, well, people admitted to faking it doesn't mean they did.
Right. That's the, I think in that case, as in a lot of things, the hoax is the claim that it was a hoax.
Right. Right.
That was the hoax. I think that can be true. And I've often wondered why those people came forward, because as time goes on, I think it's more and more clear that they were lying about having hoaxed it. But what were they after? Were they just attention seekers? Or here's the governmental conspiracy part of all of this. Was the government somehow involved in muddying the waters intentionally to keep it this kooky, apocryphal thing that everybody would just then dismiss out of hand? You know, these news anchors, every time there's somebody that comes, it's like crop circles. These two guys came forward in England and said, "Oh, we were the guys that did the crop circles. We got drunk one night and strapped these boards to our feet and walked around in circles, and there you have it." And then, all these news anchors say, "Case closed."
Yeah.
Well, first of all, look at the crop circles and just think for a minute, reasonably, is this something that two guys strapping boards to their feet could do in a night? And the answer is, I don't know if you've done much on that subject or not, but those things have just gotten so incredible.
Well, and there are ways to fake them. I mean, there are people who, there are whole clubs out there who fake them now. But back then, even when they were asked, "Well, why would you do this?" they said, "Oh, well, we were mimicking these saucer nests back home in England." And it's like, so you were mimicking unexplained phenomena.
Right, right.
But, the thing is, okay, so maybe they did go out and make some of the circles, but they clearly weren't driving all over England in one night making eight different circles.
And these fantastic algorithms, they're just breathtaking, some of these things. And they're 300 yards across, and they're expressing all of these, highly advanced mathematical principles and geometric principles. And that's been going on for 20 years at that level. And you can almost always tell the fake ones. There's some little glitch here or there. I mean, I'm sure they've gotten much better, but, at least in the beginning, you could put a hoaxed one side by side with another one that was probably not hoaxed, and you can see the difference right away. I mean, it was kind of pitiful, the comparisons. They try to make a circle, and there would be like a little flat side on the circle, or some arm of it would be crooked, or what have you. And the same thing is true with the Bigfoot phenomenon. Are there hoaxes out there? Yes, of course there are hoaxes. But it's pretty easy once you've looked at a lot of these videos. It's pretty easy to tell the hoax from what's probably a real creature. The first giveaway is the arm length. Just the body proportions are just different. There's the back step is another giveaway. Humans have a very specific angle of the angle of the hind foot when you're walking to the ground is very different from the angle that you see, the angle from the shin of the back foot on these things to the ground. Their knees are much lower to the ground as they walk. They have what's called a compliant gait, which means that whereas our tracks are staggered left and right, their tracks are in line. They swing their, and this shows up on video in the Patterson-Gimlin film and another video, but they swing their leg out and then they place it almost like a fashion model on a runway. It's like they're walking on a tightrope. And that, again, when you think about it, it makes sense. You've got a bipedal animal that's pushing 1,000 pounds. You're going to want that support as close to the middle of the center of gravity as you can. And so sure enough, that's what the trackways look like. The trackways of Bigfoots, the authentic ones, are in line. It's like they're walking on an invisible tightrope, whereas ours are left and right, and they're staggered back and forth. So that's another easy tell.
Interesting. The other thing with the crop circles is that you have people who make them who will also admit that weird stuff happens while they make them.
Really?
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's all kinds of bizarre things that'll happen while they're making circles.
Orbs of light and such.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Weird time effects and just all kinds of stuff. So even the people who are hoaxing it are having an unusual experience.
Yeah. They're getting chased away by the actual makers, maybe.
Or they're inspired to make things. That's the other thing. I remember one case where they made half a circle while someone else was making the other half of the design completely oblivious to them.
Oh, really?
And wow. They both woke up inspired to make this design.
Sounds like Close Encounters.
Yeah, a little bit.
All the people sketching the Devil's Tower in different parts of the country and all converging together.
Inspiration. But yeah, I think the Patterson-Gimlin film is probably a good piece of evidence of whatever this is. You know, you talk briefly about things like the dermal ridges and stuff that are found in the footprint. So why is that important?
Well, again, it's something that's just exceedingly hard to fake. If people don't know what I'm talking about, when you take a fingerprint, you've got these dozens or hundreds of ridges that are running around kind of in concentric circles or swirls or what have you. And when Dr. Grover Krantz, the late anthropologist, started studying this back in the late 1960s, again, same period as the Patterson-Gimlin film, and into the 70s, he discovered, as he started making casts of prints in the Pacific Northwest, that he was discovering dermal ridges on the footprints themselves. And they were, I might get this wrong, but they were oriented in a way that the great apes' dermal ridges are oriented. Ours are oriented one way. I think ours are oriented laterally across the foot, kind of east and west, and the great apes' dermal ridges are oriented north and south, if you will. And that's what he was finding on these footprints. And so you have to believe that something like that is hoaxed. You have to believe that somebody, first of all, makes the footprint in the right kind of clay, and then somehow gets down there with a needle or something and spends hour upon hour upon hour creating these concentric ridges. Basically, that's not something that can be faked. And that's why it's important. It's an important data point in all of this.
Okay. All right. You also mentioned there are no Bigfoot encounters in Hawaii, and I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And as far as I know, what surprises people is that they are in all 49 other states. There have been sighting reports, even Rhode Island. Yeah. Even Rhode Island. All of the contiguous 48 plus Alaska. And then of course, every province of Canada, which is very remote, there are sightings from, but no sightings from Hawaii. So, and that makes perfect sense.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, it's weird. It's weird that there would be sightings, for instance, in places like New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, in the Pacific Northwest, I don't have an issue with that because you have so much wooded areas that people just don't go into very often, if ever.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get to some of these more populated areas, you would think they would be seen more than they are.
Yeah, you would think so. But I think the other part of that is that there are more woods than we realize. And when we think of New Jersey, we think of New York, essentially. But there's a vast wooded area in New Jersey, too. I mean, it's called the Garden State, you know.
True.
And the the pine, let's see, I'm going to get this wrong and I'm going to
get the pine barrens.
Pine barrens. Thank you for bailing me out there. But my understanding is that's a pretty extensive area. I've got a friend who is a great author and has been studying Bigfoot for a long time, Christopher Noel, who lives in Vermont and studies them in Vermont. And he's working on a book right now, I believe, on microforests. And his YouTube channel is Impossible Visits. And you can go on there and you can see the stick structures that he's finding. And his thesis is that, yes, you might find Bigfoots out in the middle of nowhere, but you're just as likely to find evidence of them right up against civilization. I mean, blocks from a highway, a couple of acres from a rural subdivision or even a town. And he's studying these, what he calls microforests, these little areas of, you know, 5, 10, 30 acres, where he's finding stick structures and prints and hearing wood knocks and recording all of this crazy activity overnight. So, I don't know why people don't see them more, but they're seeing them a couple of dozen times every year and all over the country. I think just in the BFRO database, the Bigfoot Research Organization database, there were in excess of 30 sightings in 2017. And somebody just sent me an email this morning and said that Texas was the number 3 state for sightings after probably Washington State and California, I think it was.
And they do have distinctive differences from area to area. You know, you have the skunk ape down in Florida and such. They're not exactly the same creature. They seem to be different versions of the same creature.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's curious. I wonder, you know, is this a monolithic species with breeds? Is it like dogs with breeds or, you know, or racial differences in people? Or are we seeing different species altogether? You know, it's just an assumption that they're all one thing. They might very well be talking about 3 or 4 different kinds of creatures altogether that are very different from each other. I think there is, from what I've seen, there is a pretty high degree of consistency. Bob Garrett, who talks about East Texas, who researches East Texas, talks about 2 types just in that forest, just in Sam Houston National Forest. He says type 1s are, calls them blacks, and they're black head to toe. And, you know, and dark gray skin and a kind of a conical head. And Mitch, you see this type filmed all across the country, you know, from Washington State, British Columbia, along the Appalachian Trail. I mean, you see this kind of dark figure. And then the other one, type 2s, he calls browns, and they're a lighter, kind of more toward auburn color and have a more rounded head. And he has theories about, you know, that the brown ones are much more vicious and violent and dangerous than the black ones. But there, you know, there are 2 types right there just within this 1-3 county area in East Texas. So who knows? it's a fascinating thing to think about. You know, could there be, they've been reported really in every color of human hair. There have been blonde ones that have been spotted, a lot of gray ones that probably is just a matter of age, you know, like we are. I would qualify as a gray at this point in my life. So some of that's probably, you know, there have been white ones that's probably albinism. Mm-hmm. So there's probably different varieties, but then they probably appear different in different stages of life, or, you know, it could be malnourished and, you know, have differences because of that and so forth. But I'm wary of assuming too much. Right. I don't assume that it's all one thing, and I don't assume that, that they're all different. On the other hand, I do, because I do see a lot of the commonality across the phenomena.
Now, one of the big questions when dealing with Bigfoot is, why are there no bodies?
Mm-hmm.
And you have a couple of different ideas as to why this might be.
Well, the kind of first and foremost, you have to acknowledge, and Grover Krantz and Jeff Meldrum both talk about this, but the difficulty of anything surviving a forest environment. Nothing much survives in the forest because of the acidic soil, the amount of rainfall and the decay, the scavengers, the vultures and coyotes and so forth. So there's just, there's that aspect of it. Just purely, you know, the biome in which they live is not a biome like the desert that preserves, bones. You know, there are no chimpanzee fossils, is my understanding. And because of the fact that that's a forest creature, and when they die, their bones are consumed. So there's that. I think it's probable that because they, this kind of goes back to what I said earlier about them usually traveling in small groups. And whereas we might just see one, that's just the one we're seeing. There are two or three others within, right, within a holler. And there have been stories of, there was a story, an extraordinary story from the year 2000 out of Oklahoma. And it's known in Bigfoot circles as the Siege of Honabee. And there was a case in which over several weeks or months, this guy in this rural house was being harassed by creatures. And he was, finally, one night sitting on his porch with a rifle and took a shot at one. And no sooner than he shot that one and it started to go down, than two of them came out of the tree line and grabbed it under each shoulder and walked it off like, you know, two trainers walking a football player off a football field that's you know, turned his ankle. So if that's common, if that's the case with these things, then you can imagine that when one dies, it's either buried by others or it's eaten by others. That's always a possibility. You know, it's a ready source of protein,
right?
For a creature that probably needs a lot of it. So who knows? I mean, it could be either one of those things. You know, I don't really subscribe to some of the more magical sounding theories about Bigfoot, about interdimensional travel or that sort of thing. I'm a little bit more on the naturalistic side of it. But I'm also, as I say in the book, I think there are things we don't understand yet about them in their ability to hide. I don't think it's all just, I think there's, I call in the book, it's some sort of X factor,
yeah,
that we just are not quite understanding yet that helps them veil themselves from us. And I mean, this is kind of an offshoot to your question about why don't we find bodies. But you know, the other part of it is, I think people have found bodies, and they're just not sharing it. They're not sharing what they've found. I think that you know, there are a lot of stories of government agencies. There's one extraordinary story from Mount St. Helens that the government,
collected the dead bodies.
Some bodies when they were just kind of cleaning up wildlife of all kinds after that. And so there's, you know, and there are other stories of, you know, bodies that have, you know, disappeared into kind of Area 54 type type stuff. This is another, you know, parallel with UFO world, as the likelihood that the government knows more than it's telling us. One just, you know, and for me, it's kind of a matter of inductive reasoning that I think if there are 10,000 reports of people seeing Bigfoot, then they probably exist.
Yeah.
And if they exist, then the ones who are out in the forest all the time, i.e. the Forest Service, probably know about it. And if they know about it, they're not telling. And if that, I think that's the definition of a cover-up. So it's not, I hope it's not some tinfoil hat, conspiracy that this theorist that this makes me out to. For me, it's just sort of, it's just logical that they would know. And why they're,
yeah, why they would do it is my question.
Why they would keep it a secret?
Yeah.
That's a great question. And, one theory that I have is that, I spoke about this a little bit earlier, but if they're, it kind of goes to the nature of this animal. If they're all just this peace loving, gentle forest giant, then that's one thing. And it's not much of a, I don't know what the danger would be of them admitting to that, except that then the forests fill up with people like me who are curiosity seekers, and it just becomes a huge headache for government. But if on the other hand, they're highly dangerous, then there's an argument to be made for exterminating them. I'm not saying that's the right argument, but you could make an argument that says, well, these things are in a one-on-one situation, they're sort of all powerful. They make a grizzly bear look like, child's play. And if that's the case, and you've got a genuine concern for people that are using the forest for recreation, then you could conceive of a sort of plan where they're going out and they're just taking out as many as they can. They're just trying to keep the population down, and they're just killing them whenever and however they can, because they can't tell which ones are dangerous and which ones are not dangerous. How would you know?
Right.
And if that's the case, then, as I said before, once the cat's out of the bag, you can only imagine the restrictions that will immediately come into place, and the sort of their hands will be tied. As it stands now, it's not illegal to kill a Bigfoot.
Right. Well, it's true.
It's not illegal to kill something that doesn't exist. So the cover up then becomes all tangled up in the desire to protect people. I think it's a benevolent motive. But then you're stuck with this notion of, well, then we just have to kill them all, because how can you tell which ones are dangerous and which ones aren't? So, and I don't think that's a moral decision to make. So we're just in this weird, I believe we're just in this weird kind of crease of history where, maybe if, I've also had the thought that what if admitting their existence then, opens some other can of worms that we're not aware of. That just seems like a bridge too far for the government to have to. I mean, what if they're? I don't know exactly what I'm saying, but what if once we have one on the operating table, and once we can really get a genetic sequence of it, it tells us something about our past that the government at this point feels like we just can't handle, or something. What if it's just the inescapable conclusion after we get a genome that they were genetically engineered by people 15,000 years ago?
Right. Which is Melville Ketchum's kind of idea.
Yeah. Well, that's the, she, I don't think she's said that they, they're the subject of gene editing. But if they're a hybrid, they've got to become a hybrid some way.
Right.
And intercourse between two creatures of that is different sizes doesn't seem very plausible. It doesn't seem very practical. So it gets crazier and crazier the farther you go down this rabbit hole. But I just wonder if there's something like that, that once we've got one and can really study it, that it just opens a door to something so crazy that the government believes we just can't handle it. We have to rewrite too many textbooks. I don't know. I don't know that that's the case, but I sometimes wonder.
You, when you were doing your hike, you did find some things that you thought were structures.
Yeah, I sure did. Go ahead. Well, there are a couple of different structures that I'm pretty sure I found. The first kind is a tree bend. It's a big arch. It's a tree that's just been bent into an arch. Now, you see that a lot just happening naturally in the forest, and by no means is every bent tree in a forest so done by a Bigfoot. But when you see one that's a pretty healthy diameter that's bent over and then pinned by something else, like a log that is also taken from somewhere else, then you start to wonder, why is that bent? These yaupon trees out there will bend because the pine trees will drop a bunch of needles. They're constantly dropping their needles, and they'll drop these big mats of needles on the yaupon, and then it rains, and these mats become heavy, and that's what bends these yaupon over. Just looking around, I could tell that's what was going on with a lot of them. But every now and then, I would see one that was clearly pinned by another log that was much older than the tree itself. And so that's suspicious to me. And then the other kind were teepee structures. Now again, trees are falling this way and that way all over the forest. But when you're seeing a structure that's like a tripod, or with more, leaning to a central point like a teepee, that's a pretty well documented phenomenon right now. And we don't know what they stand for. If they stand for anything, we don't know if they're just kind of doodling with wood, or if it's some sort of territorial marker, or it's a stay out marker, or it's a come this way, this is the way home. Right. Kind of a thing. But I saw two of those that I was pretty, that looked pretty good to me. One is especially good, and it wasn't very large. It was only about 7 feet tall at the peak. But as I looked around the bottoms of these logs, there was nothing. I could tell that they had been moved from somewhere else. There wasn't a rotten stump or a root system or something underneath those logs that would have indicated that they just fell where they were growing. And the soil around this one particular structure was completely churned up as if by, hundreds and hundreds of steps. It was very wet and boggy. So, so that was interesting too. And that, I've got a couple of those pictures on my website, and also in the back of the book. The website obviously is, and I've put a couple of, I've put probably 20 or 30 pictures of other things that you'll read about in the book, on my website.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, the website for people who want it is?
It's AVRELSEALE.wordpress.com.
Okay. One of the interesting ideas that I hadn't heard before was the epigenetics idea.
Oh, right. Yeah. That, epigenetics has to do with the expression of genes, and, the you know, one way to think about it is the comparing domestic hogs, for instance, to feral hogs. And there are accounts that hogs can begin to express some pretty radical traits after going into the wild, after not a very long time. Even they become hairier. Their snouts can even start to change shape. Their skulls can even start to change shape. Their tusks or tushes, as some people call them, will grow longer and so forth. So epigenetics is the idea that maybe that we're not that different at all, that they've got the same basic genetic makeup that we do, but that the genes have just been, the genes that make you 8 feet tall have just turned on in their case, and they're turned off in our case.
Right.
And the genes that make you extra hairy are turned on in their case and turned off in our case. Now, I mean, I think there's probably enough evidence that there is speciation. I don't buy the theory that it's an intriguing theory, and the parallel is between wolves and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
The authors of the book You Are Sasquatch outlines this theory that wolves and dogs are the same animal, and that Sasquatch and humans are the same. It's just that we have self-domesticated over the course of thousands of years. And in that process of doing that, we've come down in size as dogs have come down in size from wolves, that we have become more social, as dogs are more social in their theory than wolves. You know, wolves howl to communicate across long distances, while dogs yap and bark. And so, you know, there's some compelling parallels here between wolves and dogs, and between Sasquatch and humans. If that were true, we would find more fossil evidence of ancient, huge skeletons. I think there may be something to it, but I still have a problem making I think that there's more to being a human than simply being a small hairless Sasquatch. Clearly, you've got the whole problem of culture,
right,
civilization, and interestingly, there are many people who believe they have language, which is a big marker for culture, of course. They've heard something that sounds very much like language between members of the species. So make of that what you will, but that's a little bit of a gray area, isn't it? Between, do great apes have language in the way that we have language? They're probably approaching that. In some instances, I mean, is it Coco? Is that the name of the gorilla?
Yes.
With a remarkable vocabulary. They're clearly highly intelligent, but in any event, I forgot what the original question was. But
it was just the epigenetics.
Epigenetics, right. So, yeah, I think that we're certainly more than, we have this whole spiritual dimension. We have this complex culture. Hierarchy, division of labor. I mean, if they are a snapshot of us in our early evolutionary childhood, I think that's possible that could be the case, that they're just another evolutionary line. But the genetic evidence, if you believe it, is that species is but 15,000 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem in that scenario of them just being, a very primitive version of us.
Right. And that was Melba Ketchum who put that date on it.
That's right.
What was the other thing I had here? Hang on. You were talking about there being six categories of people, and I kind of like that. The six categories of people when dealing with Bigfoot.
Right. Well, I think this is true, not just of Bigfoot, but of any mystery. Mm-hmm. And those categories, as I see them, are the seeker, who's the person that I was several years ago, who just wants to know, who's curious and wants to know the answer to the mystery. Then you've got another category that I call the rational believer. So that's someone who has seen enough evidence that they believe something is true. And then I created another category called the runaway believer, which is the person in the Bigfoot instance that believes that everything is a Bigfoot. Yeah. They're sort of intoxicated by the subject, and every bump in the night and every tree that's leaning against another tree is a stick structure, and every bare patch in the ground is a footprint, and so on and so forth. So that's just someone who's no longer applying a critical eye to the situation.
Right.
And then there's the category that I call skeptic, which in my case, in this typology, the chief vice of the skeptic is that they're not willing to investigate it themselves. They need everything to be presented to them in a nice, tidy package. They won't expend any energy whatsoever on the investigation of the truth themselves. And they sort of pride themselves on a sort of cynical pose. Hand on the hip, hand on a cocked hip, eyes rolling. And they need everything to be shown to them on a silver platter.
Right, right.
And then the last category, well, I've skipped one. There's a category that I call the knower, and that is someone who has come face to face with a Sasquatch, say, is not just a believer. They know it to their very core. They know that it exists, like they know that dogs exist, because they've had an extraordinary experience. They've come face to face with one, and there's absolutely no doubt in their mind. And so they say, I'm not a, you'll hear them say, I'm not a believer, I'm a knower.
Right.
And then on the other side, the final category, I call the denialist. And they are the ones that will really, whereas the skeptic can be convinced by showing him enough evidence, the denialist really will never allow themselves to be convinced, and they will concoct criteria that is impossible to meet. And in the case of Bigfoot evidence, it's typical for them to say, well, why are all photos of Bigfoots why are they all so fuzzy? Mm-hmm. Why are they all these, they call them blob squatches? Well, they're not. And if you show them a clear one, clear photo, they'll say, well, that's obviously a fake,
right?
So clear.
That is the issue. Yeah,
which one, what can we do? And it's true that at this point in history, there is no photo that's going to prove it. There's nothing short of a body
or alive or dead, yeah,
live capture, this or part of a body. A hand, a head would do it. I often wonder if I really did come across one that was dead, and what would be my protocol if I were out there? Would I try to take the head off and get it into my backpack, and then what? where would I drive? Would I go straight to a research university? I think at some point you would have to. My thought process in that case would be that you would need to find something outside the reach of the federal government. And you need some combination of a biological researcher and a media person who were somehow I beyond the reach. Yeah.
Safety would imply you would have to take it to the media first.
Yeah. I think that's probably right. We may never know. I keep waiting for the other shoe to drop with this thing, but
go on.
Well, I was just, those are kind of the six types of approaches to mystery that I've kind of identified through this. And I think it's true, you know, be it UFOs or lost civilizations or even faith. I think the same categories apply to faith in anything that's unseen or that's hard to grasp.
Yeah, fair enough. You mentioned missing 411 in there at one point, but you know, you're talking about getting lost by just walking a few inches off the trail at one point, or a few feet off the trail, and getting turned around. And yeah, just how easy it is to be in one of these places and get lost.
It's just incredibly easy. I mean, I was out there last week and I had a compass, a nice, $15 orienteering compass that I bought that I kind of wanted to try out. And I talked my friend into saying, well, let's just go maybe 20 or 30 minutes away from camp and then come back. And we ought to be able to, there's a creek that ran north-south there. So once we hit the creek, we'll know where we are. And again, we got out there. This is not in the book. This is after the book. And, you know, we got 50 steps away from our campsite and looked back, and you couldn't see a thing. You couldn't see any major features. There aren't mountains in the distance, you know, where you can do dead reckoning. There weren't. And it's just incredibly easy to get lost out there. And I mean, I'm sure if I grew up out there, I would have ways of navigating and getting around. But for a city dweller like me, it's just it's perilous. I mean, I in the book I talk about another hiking trip that went on with my then 7-year-old son, where we got lost inside of 60 seconds. And I had to get him to stand still, and I started walking in circles around him until I hit the trail again, and then I called him to me when I was on the trail. But that just really made an impression on me that it just doesn't take 45 seconds to get turned around out there. Yeah. And if you head back to camp and you're half a degree off, you know, you miss the camp by 300 feet, and that's it. I mean, you're out there for another couple of days, you know, until you hit a road or a highway or something. And, it's crazy.
When I first had David on, one of the things I said is that a lot of these cases I felt were going to have rational explanations. And I think that is one of them. As strange as they may seem when you look at the data, I think sometimes people just get lost.
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
But you also talk about the aggressive Bigfoots and you know, obviously when he got into this, he was, you know, went from being a Bigfoot researcher into doing the Missing 411 stuff. And aside from like the very first interview he ever did for the Missing 411 stuff, he never mentions Bigfoot again after that. Although I think that was his initial thought when he was writing the first couple of books. And then he's kind of wandered away from that a little bit for various reasons. But if these things are aggressive, it could explain some of these disappearances.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, no question. They've got the ability to do it. It's interesting how my thought process changed in all of this. Two or three years ago, it just wasn't something. Every account that I read was an account of them moving away from the camera or from the campsite or, you know, these fleeting glimpses. And then, as I, you know, began listening, especially to Sasquatch Chronicles, I don't know if he selects for these types of stories or not, but a vast majority of those accounts, of which there have, you know, I think he's done over 400 episodes now, the vast majority of those accounts are very hostile and very frightening. And whether they're true or not, it introduced the notion in my mind that that if they were true, then that could explain a lot, and that, you know, it could be big trouble for campers and hunters and, you know, outdoors people of all kinds.
Yeah. And that's what it comes down to. If these stories are true, that's the problem. There's never any diehard evidence that we can't ignore, unfortunately.
Yeah.
As of yet, anyway.
Well, that's where I am at this point giving Bob Garrett the benefit of the doubt on his stories, which are frightening. I mean, he's told of, you know, it's hard to know what's a bluff charge and what's a real charge, because presumably if the charge is real, we never hear the story.
True,
there's sort of a selective quality to, you know, all the stories of the peaceful Bigfoots are told by people who've lived to tell them. And so how do we really know, you know, what the whole picture is?
Yeah.
But I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt, because, you know, I've been out there several times now, and each time I go, there's some little tidbit of his narrative that gets confirmed to me independently. That's all I can do, right? It's all I can do is go myself and put my own person at risk to see what the truth of this matter is.
I don't, you know, when I look at all this stuff, and then you hear some of the weird encounters, like the ones that are tagged more into the paranormal Bigfoot, I often wonder if whatever is going on with the whole UFO thing, the weirdness behind it, is mimicking the Bigfoot encounters. Not so much that Bigfoot is something interdimensional, but the whatever the interdimensional thing is that's going on is also mimicking some of these phenomena. So you can have an ape out there that is undiscovered, as well as something that is paranormal.
Mm. Right. Now, we can't really assume one way or the other, can we? It's all possible.
Yeah. And I mean, you can't prove that any more than you can prove a flesh and blood Bigfoot. I mean, but obviously there are people who have collected, like, is it Stan Gordon, I think, has collected a ton of stories of, you know, Bigfoots and UFO sightings being, you know, connected.
Yeah. I've heard those. I've heard some of those stories, and there seems to be a correlation, but I don't think you need that to explain Bigfoot. Some people seem to think, but again, I am very, you'll find that I'm very slow to call anybody crazy or to claim that I know where that line is between plausible and impossible.
Right.
Because this has introduced a lot of modesty in my thinking. and I don't know where that, you know, I think there are a lot of people in the Bigfoot community who have these real hard and fast lines, like, oh, it's an ape. And it's, you know, they refuse to even call anything but an ape. I think that's partly because they want they're laying the legal groundwork for killing one. And so they don't want to admit any kind of humanity possible there. But you know, there are people who will say, well, I was with you right up until you started talking about them as part human. And now that's just crazy talk. Or, oh, I was with you until you started talking about, you know, the fact that maybe they can cloak or somehow veil themselves. And, well, that's just crazy. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't, or maybe this is something physical that we don't understand yet that they're doing with infrasound or with their electromagnetic field or whatever. But I'm not here to tell anybody that they're not seeing what they think they saw. If you see one disappear into midair, I'm not going to tell you, no, you didn't. what right do I have to say that? If you told me a purple dragon flew down out of the sky and landed in your front yard and then took off again, I would say, well, That's interesting. What's your theory? what do you think explains that? Or what did anyone else see it? You know, I'm just not in. I'm not in the business of telling people they haven't seen what they claim they see.
Yeah, because we weren't there. We don't know.
We weren't there, and you know, history is strewn with the bodies of people who denied that other people, you know, claimed what they saw, and they wound up being right. So. I don't want to be on the wrong side of history.
And I'm one of those people where I don't like, I may question the explanation somebody has for something, but I don't tend to question that people have the experience, you know, it's like, right. so they, whatever explanation you want to use for Bigfoot is fine. But as you point out in the book, we have Bigfoot encounters that go all the way back through history, all around the world. To say there's nothing to it, it that doesn't really ring true. Like there's got to be something to it for all these cases. You know, the Native Americans didn't also just make up Bigfoot encounters.
Right. It's unreasonable.
Yeah.
To rule it all out, to just turn it all out of hand. That's not a reasonable approach in my view. And people who do that simply haven't looked at the evidence.
Yeah. Yeah. And that in itself, I mean, just the fact that you have so many encounters stretched across such a long period of time makes it hard to dismiss. I mean, if you're going to be intellectually honest, people are seeing something.
Mm-hmm.
We may not be able to prove what that thing is, but people are seeing something. They're seeing it consistently, and they've seen it as far back as recorded history goes.
Right. I agree.
Under different names.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I did like the stuff you wrote about the X factor. That was definitely interesting. Because that's just not something I had really thought about with the infrasound and stuff. Mm-hmm. I had someone on who had a Bigfoot encounter, and he was trapped in his tent at one point. And if I remember right, it's been a couple of years, but I think he said that he felt like they were affecting him with some kind of infrasound.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are hundreds of accounts now. They call it zapping. That's become the shorthand for it. Mm. But it is a very common. I mean, you can't call any of this common, really.
But
it's I've read upwards of probably 100 accounts, and it's all the classic symptoms of infrasound that we know of. You know, from biological testing and military testing, it's nausea. It's panic, sort of an immediate, panic and dread, disorientation, all of that. You know, it's and interestingly, you know, the Indians claim that they could hunt, that the Sasquatches could hunt deer using hypnosis. Which is an interesting description of what infrasound might be. You know, it's sort of a stunning thing. It's literally deer in the headlights, except there are no headlights. It seems like they're basically humming a tone, a pitch that's below our ability to hear, and that is so low that it wreaks havoc on the nervous system. And people have described, I heard a description on the show Finding Bigfoot a couple of months ago. A lady described seeing a deer at the side of a pond and then seeing a Bigfoot walk out of the tree line, pick it up underneath one arm and walk back into the tree line with it. It's like it was shopping, you know, or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only way that's possible is if the deer is being stunned. Somehow. And there are other animals in nature that, you know, the tiger uses infrasound, giraffes use infrasound, whales, other large, you know, mammals are capable of that too.
And there was also, as far as getting pictures and things like this, there was a case, and I think we discussed it in one of our recent roundtables, if I'm not mistaken, where they told people, okay, we're going to put this guy in a Bigfoot outfit and we're going to send, you know, we want you to take a picture of him, and he'll be hiding in the woods up here, and people couldn't see him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a person, right? With
yeah, and that so they intentionally whoa. Told them, here he is, go take a picture, and
I heard about that. That's fascinating.
So when we say there's not a lot of pictures, well, we could walk right by these things and never know.
Right. All they have to do, I say that it's a combination of their stealth and our obliviousness.
Yeah.
And you got to have both things going, but we do. I mean, think about people walking through the woods, looking at their phone or,
right.
Or
right.
just with their head in the clouds and not really paying attention. All these things have to do really is just stand still for a second. And until we pass, and if, you know, if they want to go undetected, most of the time that's enough. They just look like a snag, or if they squat down, they just look like a stump, yeah. kind of in our peripheral vision, anyway.
All right. So again, the book is Monster Hike: 100-Mile Inquiry into the Sasquatch Mystery. It's a very well written book. It's also not your first book.
That's true. I think it's my ninth or so.
Your ninth? Okay, I was just looking for the list. You have another memoir out, plus a few fictions and some books on spirituality, did you say?
That's right, uh-huh. Got a book, a kind of a history book was the one I wrote before this one. And I've got a couple of memoirs. One's I call it a generation. It's called Dude is the title, and it's a Generation X memoir. So if you came of age in the 70s or 80s, you might get a kick out of that one.
Nice, nice. And do you have anything else planned?
You know, I don't right now. I'm just concentrating on this and in promoting it. And the wheels are starting to turn, though. I'm getting a little restless. So the next project can't be far away.
All right. Well, I thank you for spending some time with us. It's a very good book. I definitely recommend it if you're into the whole Bigfoot thing as well. It's a good, interesting read about the hike and the history and you know, miscellaneous other stuff that went into this for you and what it meant to you.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I'm really honored that you wanted to talk to me about this.
And the website one more time?
It's Averell. It's A-V-R-E-L, Seal. That's S-E-A-L-E, .wordpress.com. And the book is available on Amazon and barnesandnoble.com.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a special thanks to our Patreons who are pledging at the $10 or above level. John Eddy, Chris Elmquist, Patricia Gaiaquinta, Allison Cook, Robert Groom, Christopher Sheehan, Roland Belstedt, Kevin Shrek, Super Inframan, Alfred Tuttle, Carla Mahoney, and Gabriel Zero. Thank you very much. All right, and that concludes my conversation with Averell. There is an extra segment for patrons only. Sign up to be a patron if you want to check that out. It's about 20 minutes long. And there's more stuff coming for patrons. I'm going to try to do a giveaway this month, what's left of it. And yeah, a couple other cool things I'm going to be posting. Again, if you are listening to this show on WVBR, which is the first time the main show airs, that's not counting roundtables and stuff that go up during the week. You're going to be able to hear us starting next week at 10 p.m. instead of 11 p.m. Eastern. And next week is also our 5th anniversary show. And if all goes well, it's going to be a UFO history show dealing with 2017, because a bunch of stuff happened in 2017. Some really big stuff at the end. So we're going to talk about the stuff that happened in 2017 with Mike Cleland and Aaron Gullius. So part, 6090 of the UFO history series dealing just with 2017. So that will be next week, the 27th, if you're listening to it live or shortly after that on Dark Matter and posted to the website and iTunes and YouTube and stuff like that. All right. Thank you very much. We're going to take you out with some March and Beauty. This is a song called Wish Book. See you next time.
You have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.